Boys, I've been feeling a little icky. I'm under the weather. Yeah.
Because you're American?
Yeah. No, I'm...
Unfortunately.
We
I don't think there's a solution for that one.
There is one, but it's a little permanent. I'm not at that point yet.
No, you can balkanize as well.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Maybe one of these days. Republic of Texas. All right.
I could swallow you a bit better if you were just a Texan.
Oh, you could.
That was phrasing. Yeah, that was phrasing.
Anyway.
You always go down smooth, have you?
Oh, shucks. Well, Chelsea's been taking Evie to the local library because they do like a...
She can read already? Jesus Christ.
Not really.
You're smart and your wife is smart, but that's smart. Your kid? Oh, my.
She can't read. Like, she can recognize some words because she recognizes the pictures on the page, but that's about it.
Ah, okay. Typical American teenager then, okay.
Yeah, exactly. We're all illiterate here.
I'm really harping on the American thing.
But they went to this like story time thing where they do, you know, bubbles and books and sing songs and stuff like that, and Evie had a great time. Mm-hmm. She's been saying library lady all this last week. She wants to see the library lady again. But of course, you know, anytime there's a congregation of children, at least 50% of them are like hacking up a lung with some horrible illness that they have. So,
sex of disease.
Yeah. Evie got it. Then Kelsey got it. And I was fine for like a week while they had it. And then the last couple days, it just hit me like a ton of bricks.
It was incubating.
Just waiting to strike.
My child and my wife are suffering. I was fine, but now I have it and it sucks, okay?
Yeah, this is the worst. No one's ever suffered like this. Yeah,
classic husband behavior, okay?
Exactly. I've got a little cold. And so I feel like I remember you saying something about this before, Hakeem. And tell me if this is insane. Do I remember you saying that every time you get a cold, it's a different cold?
Yeah.
Like you can't get the same cold twice.
Yeah, there's over 200 different kinds of, common cold viruses.
Uh-huh.
And every time you get one, it's basically either a different one or a slightly different strain of one you've had earlier.
That's why you feel like the symptoms are changing all the time. I think that was the question. Right. Are they evolving? Are these like are they building them in the Chinese lab or something to fight their degenerate capitalist asses? But no, apparently there's a lot of them. They're a big family, okay?
Exactly right. And the closer a particular strain is to one you've had earlier, the more mild the symptoms can be, and the inverse as well. It's a little more complicated than this, but this is a general idea. That's why also, for example, like you could be chilling and not be ill for a good 2 month period, but the second you go to a different location, for example, you travel to another country, then like the first 3 days you immediately get hit with something. Your system isn't used to all the new pathogens.
No, that's actually sense. Havana syndrome. Do you guys know that it's back? I just watched on stream a BBC fucking 1 million views piece. 10 minutes. It's back, dude. It's back, and they're interviewing little Bond villain looking FBI lady, and she's like, "I was sitting at home, and all of a sudden, I heard a loud pinging noise, and my head started to hurt." I'm like, "Motherfucker, that's a migraine. Fuck are you talking about? Jesus,
it's the brain ray."
And the BBC lady interviewing all of these people, and there's a journalist. Like, imagine you went to school and like you wanted to become a respectable journalist, and they referred to him as an expert on Havana syndrome. Like, that's your whole career. They just call you up to talk about the thing that you probably also believe isn't true, and they're interviewing this schmuck, right? And she's asking him all sorts of questions. She's like, "Do the Russians have the technology to build this out? Jeez. Why do we call it the Havana syndrome? Is this where the technology was built out originally?" But at no point does she maybe think of saying, "Hey, headaches. maybe this is not an actual thing that is being used against America." And even to an extent, the State Department agrees. And the guy spins that by saying, you know, these operatives that serve our country, they feel a bit let down by their leadership because they are ignoring their, you know, what they're saying that they're actually experiencing. They're denying their experience, okay? They're being ableist against their fucking, oh, God. Fucking shoot me. But no, even if this existed, this is the worst thing to spend your military budget on that I've ever heard in my life. Imagine like
the inconvenience 100
Russian
yeah.
scientists yeah, and 100 Cuban scientists like sitting in a lab fucking spending billions, trillions of dollars on this. And then it just gives headaches yeah. to yeah. white people. Like fucking legendary.
I remember reading about, I've seen something about a CIA heart attack gun. Yeah. So I looked it up and there's a CIA.gov like declassified report about the Soviet use of assassination and kidnapping. And they have this little sentence where like, these techniques frequently designated as executive action and known within the KGB as liquid affairs. And then they translate it like directly from Mokri Diela.
Yeah.
what a strange direct translation. but yeah, I'm looking up this fucking heart attack gun shit. And there's like podcast episodes and like, you know, other ship. I don't see any, although they claim... They claim that the Soviet Union had also a heart attack gun.
It's like when NASA did the space pen thing that could write in space upside down. It's like, bro, you could just use a pencil. Why not just use a normal gun?
That military budget has to go somewhere. But you gotta give it to the Ruskies. I don't know if some of the assassinations were done by them or just Western propaganda or whatever. But why do they always like do like extremely complicated attacks? Like, you know, there's guns. There's
no innovation
a pistol,
on the communism,
like,
okay?
Like different like poisonings and like blah, 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 blah. And I know every state around the world does it, but it's something, I don't know, probably like I'm orientalizing them to an extent. But the Ruskies are always doing some weird like, whoa, like chemical called Smegma 77. It makes you go purple before you die. And they put it in an umbrella and they like tap you on the bus. I'm like, dude, there's a gun and a silencer. What are you doing?
My favorite two tidbits are, number one, the KGB cigarette pack, which if once you open it, it's actually like six barrels of a gun and they all fire at the same time. Yeah. that and also the time that they had some unnamed Cuban official who was gonna go and assassinate. He was convinced that he wanted to assassinate Castro, but then when the CIA brought him the poison dart gun or whatever that they had, it was like a bullet point pen with like a little needle in it, and then this guy was he was so cringed out. He was like, this is the best you can do. Then afterwards, he lost contact with them. And he went back to being a regular official.
Maybe these communists are better. Okay, Jesus.
CIA produces worst assassination tool ever. Stops collaborating. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to this program. Today, we have another beautiful, fantastic episode for all our lovely little piggies, who we'd like to thank. First of all, our biggest thanks is to our patrons who make all this possible. Without your help, this would not be possible. But also to all the lovely people on the Discord and everybody else who comments and shares their opinions and whatnot with us. It really brings a smile to our face. And helps us, develop and keep going. So thank you for all the positive feedback and constructive feedback and all that. But yeah, today's episode is a kind of a theory light, I guess. It is about trade unions, but we're going to kind of go over basically the generic history of it, both good and bad examples historically, what is the capitalist perspective on the socialist theory and approach to unionization and whatnot. And then afterwards, we're going to get into the more fun stuff. At least in my opinion, which is the union busting stuff, what examples it takes, the place of unions within socialist society, etc., etc. JT will intro us with all the lovely historical information, so please take it away, Habibi.
I love just for the listeners, Hakim just greased his thick brown dick so hard. He was like, we're going to go through these parts that are not that interesting, and then we're going to talk about the interesting part. Guess which part his Hakim part. Is covering. Yeah. Guess which
exactly
part he's
right.
fucking covering.
Yeah.
Mine's also the shortest segment. But that's because I have all these fucking links that I sprinkle throughout.
All right. Well, I guess I'll get started with my boring section.
before that, hold on. My topic is union busting techniques.
Ooh.
Can you please tell me about your busting techniques, JT? Uwo, please.
Ooh. I'd like to bust with you boys as a union. All right. Let's start with a little basic
The only union busting I like to do is our union when we bust. Oh.
Bro, I just made that joke. That's the same damn joke.
What? Okay. We know English speak. Keep both.
Keep both, please.
Yeah, well.
Oh, my God.
All right, let's start with a little basic information. One disclaimer up front, I'm just going to use the word union most of the time, but if you hear me say labor union or trade union, it all means the same thing. Americans tend to use labor union, and the goddamn European commies use trade union, but they are all interchangeable. It means the same stuff. Okay, so what is a union? The short version is pretty simple. A union.
What about marriage, though?
That is not as simple, I'll tell you what.
The Marxist perspective towards marriage loses all listeners.
Yeah, sorry, please.
Anyway, a union is an organization of people, usually from the same industry, whose purpose is to improve the working conditions within that industry. So you've got unions for things like auto workers, medical personnel, actors and screenwriters, pretty much anything you can think of. While they
cops.
All have demand... What?
Cops.
No, cops. Cops yeah, do not deserve a union. They're fake. Yeah. Cops, cop union, asterisk.
That's not a union. It's just called the mob, okay? It's a legal mob, okay? That's what
no kidding. Please. Yeah, you see that post from, who was it? That one congressperson who was a cop at one point. He sent a picture of the New York police on their big old parade thing. He said, don't cross
we'll
us
do
or don't ever cross
us. Cross
yeah.
us.
You're fucking
don't
losers.
Cross the boys in blue.
Oh, I hate them so much.
Such dorks, my God.
Really are just aggrieved about everything. They feel so fragile. Anyway, they all have demands specific to their segment of the labor market, but they all share certain overarching goals, like better wages, safer working conditions, securing additional rights in the workplace, better benefits, preventing unjust termination, stuff like that. Unions have power because they're not just atomized individuals complaining about work. They have organizational structures, they have rules, legal teams, offices, funding, all the stuff that gives workers a fighting chance at winning concessions from the boss. Union leadership is elected by members, and funding is secured through fees called dues, usually paid annually. And this is one of the ways that the ruling class tries to get workers to oppose unions. They're like, oh, you have to pay for the privilege of going to meetings? Wouldn't you rather buy a PlayStation? And that's an actual example, which is just, it's so stupid. A couple of years ago, one of the airlines, I think it was Delta, put out a bunch of displays, like, you know, those big cardboard cutout displays showing what you could buy with union dues. Like, just really
fuck
shitty behavior.
Fuck me.
I know. Whoa. It was so dumb. It was like a big PS5 stand that they put out and some, like, little presents and stuff. Really cringe. And incredibly transparent, too. Like, if you think about it at all, you'll realize that the dues you pay will be more than made up for by the better wages and benefits the union wins you as a worker. But anyway, that's a little side tangent.
Yeah, remember when they used to buy off workers by telling them you can roam the streets and kill disgusting commies or minorities, you know? The right has talked so much about tradition, yet has strayed so far away from it. Now it's, oh, you want to play the new Elden Ring? Do not be left wing. Oh my God, it even rhymes.
such losers. Like, what do people like? Video games? I don't know. Well, let's do a quick crash course on the history of unions. We shall begin in the year 2334 BCE, following the unification of the city-states of Assyria and Sumer by Sargon of Akkad into a single empire. I'm joking. We're not going to go back that far because that's for nerds. Yeah. I'm not a nerd.
Man, Sargon has been alive for so long. Boy, dropped off so hard, bro.
Yeah, fucking pathetic. Uniting empires and now streaming? Fuck that guy. Okay. I'm joking. Anyway, you can
still alive even. Sorry,
I don't know.
The off tangent.
I never known who the guy is.
In that regard,
is he?
Yeah, he joined UKIP and then like failed when he got 23 votes.
Lamau.
Oh wow. So you mean the internet isn't real life?
Gamers don't vote.
Cringe. Anyway,
except
you can trace
for which next map to play on COD. Okay, I'm done. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, you're good. You can trace at least some form of trade unionism back a long way. But for our purposes, we're going to stick to the modern interpretation. Unions, as we conceive of them today, started to gain traction when the U.S. was still a teeny tiny baby country. The first recorded labor strike in the U.S. was in Philadelphia in 1786. Probably something about cheesesteaks, I don't know. Most people point to the British Industrial Revolution.
I was literally about to make the same joke. God fucking damn.
That's why I speak quickly. I got to beat you to it because I know you're going to steal my jokes. The British Industrial Revolution as the birthplace of the modern union, when masses of people moved from the countryside into the cities and began to organize among themselves in a factory setting for the first time. But it wasn't just because people were in a new environment. They had become an entirely new class of worker, a wage worker. Previously, you'd had farmers, craftspeople, serfs, and so on. But now you had a new kind of worker entirely dependent on the people who owned the factory and the machinery to do the work. Labor and capital. The people who sold their labor power, and the people who owned the means of production and bought that labor power in exchange for a wage. This new arrangement was precarious. The workers had nothing to bargain with, and they didn't own the fruits of their labor. And so people figured out pretty quickly that they were powerless on their own, and so they started to form the first labor unions. Business owners and the government really didn't like the unions, and routinely cracked down on them both legally, through bills like the Sherman Antitrust Act, and extrajudicially, with beatings, shootings, and other forms of physical coercion.
Despite wish you'd beat and shoot.
And otherwise physically coerce you, yeah.
Exactly right.
I got the fuzzy handcuffs for you, partner, I tell you what. Despite enormous persecution, unions quickly took root, and by the 1810s, we began to see the first cross-industry unions designed to organize people of different specializations. Over the next half century, unions went through periods of more and less militancy, trying to find the balance that would win them the most concessions without getting completely steamrolled by the government and the police. It wasn't until 1872 that trade unions were officially legalized in England. This period also saw the growth of unions in other industrializing countries, like the US, France, and Germany. Union activity would expand across most of the industrialized world over the next few decades, with labor and capital coming to an uneasy peace, each recognizing that the other wasn't going anywhere for the time being, and each trying to outmaneuver the other through mostly legal means. Unions trying to win as much as they could for their members, and bosses trying to trim as much fat as possible to maximize profits. These two goals, obviously, are diametrically opposed. Now, let's take a look at two particular unions, the IWW and the AFL-CIO, because they represent excellent case studies at what good and bad unions look like. The AFL-CIO is the US's largest union federation, basically an umbrella union that supports a number of constituent unions, representing some 12 million workers. That sounds pretty good. The only problem is, they have a troubling track record of supporting the US government in destabilizing left-wing movements around the world, especially in Latin America. During the Cold War, the AFL-CIO was headed by rabid anti-communists, all of whom were dedicated to undermining the growth of proper left-wing union movements abroad. These guys were scumbags, to put it plainly, and not too bright, if I can give it my own opinion. They believed in what was called business unionism, the idea that getting rid of capitalism was a bad idea, and that instead they should work together with capitalists to improve the conditions of their workers. The obvious problem with that is what we mentioned before. The goals of labor and capital are diametrically opposed. If you don't get rid of capitalism, that contradiction will never be resolved, and capital will always maintain power over labor. But the AFL leadership had a different perspective. They figured that as long as the US had easy access to foreign markets and could generate higher profits by selling US goods abroad, US workers would see higher wages and more stable employment. This economic nationalism fueled a sort of xenophobic anti-solidarity among US workers. Big, they took our jobs energy. The AFL-CIO would continue to cheerlead coups, destabilization, and imperialist policy for decades, earning them the nickname the AFL-CIA by class-conscious workers, which is a banger nickname, I must say. There's a lot more to say about the group in more recent years, but I don't want to belabor the point, so we'll just leave them at that, and we'll move on to the IWW. Where the AFL-CIO can be considered an imperialist union and thoroughly co-opted...
Volkswagen? International Volkswagen? The people sure. Shall reserve a car!
I wouldn't trust a
Lebensraum for a Volkswagen.
Exactly. Yeah, that's not what we need. We don't need a Volkswagen union. Yeah, AFL-CIO can be considered imperialist and thoroughly co-opted. The IWW is a great example of what a labor union should look like under capitalism. The IWW, or Industrial Workers of the World, is a revolutionary general union, representing thousands of workers from various industries. They're not afraid of using radical language, and they recognize the importance of defending the rights of labor everywhere, rather than just at home.
But I still don't get it. Do you get a Volkswagen when you join?
That is VW, my friend, not WW.
Ah, okay, so it's like four V's, WW, so it's it's like Volkswagen squared. You get two Volkswagens when you join.
If it's a bus, I will join. Fun fact, there's a guy in my neighborhood who has this gorgeous yellow VW bus that he's been working on for quite a while, and he got it running the other day and was driving it around. Oh, it's so pretty. Ah, why aren't cars as cool as these?
But like the pothead hippie one or a newer one?
No, the hippie one. Not the modern reinterpretation, not the electric one, but like a classic late 60s or early 70s. Oh, so pretty.
That's always
perfect
sexy.
Condition. Yeah. Anyway, the organization almost went extinct during the first and especially the second Red Scare. The U.S. government cracked down hard. It was banned entirely in Canada. The AFL-CIO went on the attack with slanderous campaigns. And countless members ended up jailed in communist witch hunts. It should tell you something that the AFL-CIO thrived in this period. They were never a threat to capital. The IWW has managed to survive and is now growing steadily again thanks to the new wave of labor militancy we've seen over the past few years. But here's what makes the IWW the best example of a union under capitalism. They promote the concept of one big union and believe that all workers should be united as a social class to replace capitalism and wage labor with industrial democracy. This is known as the wobbly shop model of workplace democracy, through which workers elect their own manager and other forms of self-management are implemented. A wobbly is an IWW member, by the way. No one really knows where wobbly came from as a nickname, but it stuck. The IWW does not require its members to work in a represented workplace, nor does it exclude membership in any other labor union. It uses radical language, has a genuinely class-conscious approach to forcing change, and is not afraid to get involved in fights with capital across the entire labor landscape. That's about as good as it gets under our current system. And that is about it for the history. We could go into, you know, specific instances of union busting, but the long story short is that union organizers try to do something, they march, they strike, cops come in, murder a few people, beat everybody back into line, they might get a couple concessions here and there. And that's about it from the 1800s to today. But I want to end with a little snippet from Lenin's What is to be Done, where he stresses the importance of relying not only on economic organization, which is what you typically see in trade unionism, but also political organization and education. Why is it that the Russian workers as yet display so little revolutionary activity in connection with the brutal way in which the police mistreat the people, in connection with the persecution of the religious sects, with the flogging of the peasantry, with the religious censorship, with the persecution of the most innocent cultural enterprises? Is it because the economic struggle does not stimulate them to this? Because such political activity does not promise palpable results?
You stimulate me.
Like, he's just waiting. He's like, okay. He's got a list of words.
I'm sorry.
He's got a list of words. He's like, oh, stimulate. There it is. Just waiting. Here's back to Lenin. To advance this argument is merely to shift
Agent
the blame
activated.
Onto the shoulders of others. Come on. To blame the masses of workers for our own failings. We must blame ourselves, our remoteness from the mass movement. We must blame ourselves for being unable as yet to organize a sufficiently wide, striking, and rapid exposure of these despicable outrages. Only those who themselves go into action now can make appeals for action. And our business as socialists is to deepen, expand, and intensify political exposures and political agitation. And then he goes on to talk about the importance of planting the seed of political understanding and how spontaneity is never enough to cause a rupture in the existing order. The fact that these strikes spread over the whole of Russia showed how deep the reviving popular movement was, and if we must speak of the spontaneous element, then, of course, we must admit the strike movement bore a spontaneous character. Strikes occurred in Russia in the 1860s and 70s, as well as the first half of the 19th century, and these strikes were accompanied by the spontaneous destruction of machinery, etc. Compared with these revolts, the strikes of the 1890s might even be described as conscious. To such an extent do they mark the progress which the labor movement has made since that period. This shows that the spontaneous element, in essence, represents nothing more nor less than consciousness in its embryonic form. Even the primitive rebellions express the awakening of consciousness to a certain extent. The workers abandoned their age-long faith in the permanence of the system which oppressed them. They began, I shall not say to understand, but to sense the necessity of collective resistance. So there Lenin is basically saying, with a lot of fancy words, that yes, it's important that we pursue organizing on the economic front, you know, getting people agitated about conditions in their job, with their boss, explaining that, you know, a pay raise less than the percentage of inflation is actually a pay cut, stuff like that, that matters on the economic level to the workers. But we also need to focus on political agitation, trying to tie those ills of the factory or your shop floor or wherever you work to the wider problem of capitalism as a whole. Why the boss acts the way he does is not just an economic thing, it's a political thing. But we'll get to that in a little bit. And with that, I will hand it off to my beloved Yugopnik.
Sorry, but just before you go, I do remember the stupid thing I saw the other day. You know, American, not, what's it called? Political cartoons are a very American thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember I saw this one, and it's Obama, and he's sitting at a round table, and he's saying something to the form of his economic advisors are gone or have left him or something, uh-huh. But he still has his old trusty ones that he can lean on. I remember right, it was Homer Simpson, Mickey Mouse, and Fidel Castro at the fucking table. I don't know what they're what is that trying to say?
Doesn't matter. That's a beautiful image.
My God. If somebody can find that, please send this.
Art for the sake of art. Yes, I'll make it the fucking cover of the episode. But yes, now as JT has beautifully taken us for a ride through the history of unions, let me give you a ride through the history of socialist thought and unions. Yes, baby. Like on most things, there's plenty of hot takes to be shuffled through. So I ask you to bear with me as I sit here. This is maybe the most serious I've taken myself in any episode when it comes to writing this shit. Okay, let's start with Marx and Engels themselves. Now, socialists have long grappled with the complex role of labor unions within the framework of Marxist theory. On one hand, these unions serve as vital organs for organizing the proletariat, enabling collective action and resistance against the dominant capitalist class, as JT has shown through the Lenin's quote. Yet, on the other hand, they often prove inadequate as mechanisms for mobilizing workers towards a comprehensive societal transformation. This nuanced relationship underscores the paradoxical nature of labor unions within Marxist thought. The historical trajectory of labor unions has been intertwined with the broader struggle for workers' rights and emancipation. From their emergence as small organizations aimed at protecting workers' interests to their evolution into formidable entities capable of challenging capitalist hegemony, unions have played a pivotal role in shaping the contours of class conflict. When discussing the working class or working class activity, one invariably refers to actions undertaken either by unionized workers or those endeavoring to organize into unions. Nevertheless, despite their indispensability in facilitating working class solidarity, labor unions are not immune to critique within the Marxist circle. Their existence inherently affirms and perpetuates the prevailing capitalist social order by functioning primarily as negotiators of wages, benefits, and workplace conditions within the capitalist framework. Unions inevitably become kind of taken in by the reformist idea, seeking to ameliorate rather than eradicate the structural inadequacies inherent to the capitalist mode of production. This tension within labor unions is not merely theoretical. It manifests concretely in their operational dynamics. While some unions have exhibited radical tendencies, challenging the entrenched power structures of capital, others have adopted more conciliary stances, basically giving up to the status quo and prioritizing incremental gains over revolutionary change. Moreover, the historical trajectory of unions has witnessed oscillations between insurgent mobilization and just bureaucratic entrenchment, further complicating their role in the broader class struggle. At the heart of Marx's debates surrounding labor unions lie four fundamental questions that interrogate their efficacy as instruments of class formation and revolutionary praxis. Firstly, to what extent do unions reflect existing relations of production and class struggle as opposed to actively shaping them? Secondly, under what conditions do unions enhance or hurt the advancement of class struggle? Thirdly, how do unions influence the formation of class identities, and how does this affect their scope of action? And lastly, what is the relationship between unions and politics, particularly concerning the transition from economic to political struggles? Marx and Engels, in their extensive writings on unions, grappled with these questions in the context of their own time. They recognized the vital role of unions in fostering working class solidarity and contesting bourgeois domination. However, they also acknowledged the inherent limitations of unions as instruments of proletarian revolution, being the key word. While unions served as crucial arenas for organizing collective action, as we've heard throughout their history later, even after Marx and Engels died from JT, the reformist tendencies and narrow focus on immediate workplace concerns often precluded broader transformative agendas. The historical analysis provided by both Marx and Engels laid the groundwork for subsequent Marxist debates on the role of labor unions in class formation and struggle. Their insights into the dialectical relationship, or more fancy words, between unions and capitalism underscores the complex interplay between economic and political forces within the broader framework of class struggle. Moreover, Artaud-Boy's recognition of the contingent nature of union activity and their caution against uncritical embrace of reformist tendencies anticipated later critiques of union bureaucratization and co-optation by capital. While unions undoubtedly represent very important spaces for working class organization, their potential as agents of revolutionary change remains contingent upon their ability to kind of transcend the limitations imposed by capitalist hegemony and embrace a more expansive vision of societal transformation. Thus, it's very important for us to talk about their role within a socialist system as a tool to bring one forward. After Marx and Engels had died, Marxists all over the world struggled to grapple with the durability of capitalism, and the conservatism of the working class sparked intense debates. Some, like for example Edward Bernstein, proposed revising Marx's revolutionary overthrow of the bourgeoisie in favor of something that was titled evolutionary socialism, where unions, parliamentary parties, and cooperative associations would gradually democratize the economy, displacing capitalists. Our least favorite boy, Kautsky, disagreed, emphasizing the need for unions to cultivate socialist consciousness. Despite his optimism that unions would play a pivotal role in overcoming capitalism, the reality of workers' organizations suggested otherwise. To explain working-class conservatism, some theorists drew on Marx and Engels' observation to argue that employers have effectively bribed skilled workers with super profits, creating conservative labor aristocracy. Lenin expanded this idea, attributing workers' conservatism to colonial super profits and the rejection of international solidarity. Critics questioned this theory, highlighting cases where skilled workers spearheaded leftist movements. Other theorists, though, blamed workers' conservatism on organizational structures themselves. Syndicalists saw formal organization as hindering workers' revolutionary potential, as syndicalists always do, while other anarchists warned of organizational oligarchy, whatever that might mean. Rosa Luxemburg, drawing from her experience, emphasized workers' self-activity and mass strikes, though she recognized the need for organized leadership. Her views fully aligned with Lenin's, who stressed the importance of mass action, complemented by party intellectuals, to bridge economic and political struggles. Gramsci, for example, as well, advocated for uniting political, economic, and ideological dimensions of class struggle through unions and factory councils, basically bringing it down to the level of the worker. In the decades following Marx's and Engels's deaths, debates on working class organization grappled with all of these fundamental issues. While mass action occasionally led to transformative moments, sustaining constant class activity proved borderline impossible, at least through unions. Balancing organizational necessity with the risk of conservatism and bureaucratization remained central to the dilemma. Moving forward, in the early 20th century, a surge in worker activism established unions as legitimate and legally recognized entities in most Western industrialized nations. However, the defeat of radical left movements during this time shifted the focus away from unions' revolutionary potential, as we've heard with particular examples from JT. By the end of World War II, bureaucratic industrial relation regimes had emerged in Western countries, integrating unions into systems of formalized collective bargaining. This integration was practically supported by social democratic parties, oh my God, the surprise, and welfare state regimes. In contrast, Bolsheviks, meaning Soviet communists in the Eastern Bloc, mostly absorbed unions into the party apparatus. As JT said, the Cold War geopolitical landscape shaped relations between parties, unions, and states, constraining political discourse. This geopolitical tension limited union militancy, which again is very important, and pressured unions to become responsible social partners, quote unquote, meaning partners of the capitalist himself. Mainstream industrial relations scholars viewed unions' post-war pacification as part of a natural maturing process, managing class divisions through industrial so-called pluralism. However, Marxists viewed these changes with unease, recognizing them as built on the defeat of pre-war workers' uprisings and broader socialist vision. They were pacified. Post-war gains were seen as the result of workers' accommodation within the capitalist system rather than revolutionary action. Some theorists argued that unions and the working class had been co-opted by the national bourgeoisie, while others contended that post-war changes had rendered the working class less revolutionary and even relevant. The debate over the key revolutionary agent, which I think is debated to this day, shifted back then at least towards students, intellectuals, and the global peasantry for many. Some tendencies, like the Kochrentians in the United States, emphasized defending and improving union structures to mobilize workers collectively. They saw union democracy as essential for developing unity in action and transforming workers' consciousness.
Right after World War II. The Cochranites.
I didn't want to say the word cock, but if you insist, okay. Right after World War II, the working class saw real material gains due to post-war economic growth. But these gains came under threat as the post-war economic boom ended in the 70s. An assault on unions led by employers in states across industrialized nations eroded wages and social policies, disorienting labor and left-wing politics. Communist parties declined, and social democratic parties abandoned commitments to the working class moving towards liberalism. I think only through this analysis we saw social democrats betraying 5 to 6 times, like the least treasonous social democrat. Hey,
yeah.
Marxists grappled with the evolving role of unions and the potential for challenging capital throughout the existence of our beautiful idea. Some argued that declines in manufacturing and the rise of technical jobs had fundamentally altered the class structure, questioning the relevance of the working class itself. Others cautioned against mistaking class recomposition for class demise, emphasizing the continued importance of unions and workers in new forms of socialist struggle. For Marxists committed to the working class as the key agent of social change, the challenge was rebuilding power amid these faltering socialist parties and unions. Here we're talking specifically about the West. Strengthening rank-and-file organizations and cultivating a militant minority were proposed solutions, but efforts faced challenges like conservative union leadership and industrial decline. In the U.S., rank-and-file union reform caucuses emerged but had limited success, often absorbed into union leadership or fading with collapsing industries. Despite setbacks, though, these efforts defended the Marxist insight of the working class as the key agent of change and laid the groundwork for future organizing. So what's happening today? Well, after enduring four decades of decline and defeat, labor unions find themselves in a precarious position. With their political and economic aspirations constrained and the lofty goal that our daddies, Marx and Engels, gave seemingly distant. However, recent events offer glimmers of hope. Capital's further push to rid workers of any semblance of decency through the proliferation of the gig economy, the further push to the right by most Western states, and the radicalization of the wider populace, both to the left and the right, are putting unions in an interesting position, where even the sometimes bureaucratic, self-preserving heads of said unions are understanding that negotiation with their capitalist bosses are no longer even in their own self-interest, and that taking it soft and slow no longer satisfies even the basest of workers' interests that they pretend to protect. But I'll leave the future to the brilliant Hakim to handle.
Habibi, thank you both for a beautiful, beautiful walkthroughs and wide spanning ideas, as well as other words that I was thinking of that can kind of sneak you molesting me through. All right. Now moving on to the future that has already been made. When it comes to unions or trade unions in general, as you enter into socialism, the difference is that under capitalism, you're doing this collective bargaining against, you know, a capitalist, right? There's the class antagonism there. Under socialism, the entire idea is that the working class will be the ones with political power. As a result, historically, you saw, and it's the setup that really does make sense in my mind, you saw a system of incorporation of trade unions. Unions were not independent of the nation state or its administrative bodies. Instead, they were actually directly involved. They played a direct role in governing, usually in the sphere of production, meaning that they had the, you know, boring day-to-day planning, production meetings in cooperation with other economic centers. They had education organizing activities for the workers within said union, which, by the way, practically every worker within a particular industry belonged to the union, so it was an all-encompassing system. They took care of organizing daycare and maternity leave and paying out pensions and all this kind of stuff. At least this was the historical socialist example. The idea of collective bargaining doesn't exactly work the same way, since, as I mentioned, there's no wage labor. The class antagonism is very different. Work under capitalism is divided, for the bit that covers your wage, and then the rest that goes as surplus value that's extracted by the capitalist. But under socialism, it's instead broken up into work for oneself and work for society. We have a very early episode on this concept. But the idea is that through this work for society, you contribute into a national surplus, a fund of sorts, but it is not a surplus value extraction in that sense, because there is no, as mentioned, there is no wage labor. This is based on directly agreed to terms, where you have kind of almost like a quote-unquote social contract, where you directly contribute to the improvement of your communities and whatnot. This is not, you're not creating value that's going into the private hands for private purposes, particularly to be reinvested in the circuit of capital. But this is getting way above the scope of what we need to talk about today. The mutual dialogue of unions under socialism with the other official bodies kind of runs parallel to other sorts of political engagement, meaning from council levels, local councils, and councils even within the trade union, all the way up into some like national council, you know, Supreme Soviet in the Soviet example, or People's Assembly like in the Chinese example, or, you know, the similar examples in Cuba and Vietnam and everywhere else, really, that was socialist historically as well as currently is. This runs parallel to those institutions as well as party politics. So it's much more of a governing body than institution for the fight or agitation for better working conditions. Excuse me. Fuck. No, I hope that's not as boring for the people listening. Goddamn. All right.
Hey, they want to learn something today. They learn something, motherfuckers.
Yeah, exactly right. But yeah, that's the general idea. As to the future, of course, there's ideas of syndicalism, of having quote unquote independent unions, but not to be like too much of a stickler for the shit, but every time there was talk of a quote-unquote independent union within a socialist country, it was almost exclusively a fifth column made specifically to undermine the socialist experiment, specifically with the direct aiding of US or NATO or other nefarious funding sources. The Solidarity movement in Poland is the perfect example of this. So, yeah, like there is some talk that can be had, but generally the historic example is the one that makes the most sense. Regardless, we've discussed already now why you should join a union, but what do employers do exactly when they hear union talk? This is kind of the union busting segment that we're going to discuss now. First of all, what is union busting? Union busting is basically any action by management, I mean management within a particular corporation or company, to prevent employees from exercising their right to organize, to agitate mutually, like a fight for better circumstances, better pay, and other conditions. There are several ways that this is done, but first of all, I want to talk about the money in this, which is absolutely ridiculous. JT, could you please guess how many or how much money is spent per year in the United States on union busting activities?
$40.
All right, a little more realistic. What do you think?
Let's see. 15 million.
400.
Jesus Christ.
Employers spend more than $400 million per year on union avoidance, quote unquote, union avoidance consultants.
Wow.
Consultants, fuck me. To drive their union busting efforts. This is published by the Economic Policy Institute, and they have a nice little write-up, actually, where they talk about, they refer to it through these euphemisms, union avoidance, but you know what they mean, union busting activities.
Yeah.
And they basically discuss that workers, when they want to form a union, so the employers hire these union avoidance consultants to basically weaken the unionization efforts or to dissuade workers. And these include over $400 million, something to $433 million per year on these consultants. These consultants work and receive around $350 or more hourly rates, or $2,500 per day rates. And these are things that can go on for many weeks or months. So you can imagine how expensive or how lucrative, at least, this is. The estimates that exist really are not all-encompassing because through some legal fuckery, you can't actually know how much they spend. And I'm going to get into exactly why. But there are like statutory exemptions and enforcement limitations and all this other bullshit where they can kind of get around it. And this is some more fun stuff, but let me just run some numbers by you. Amazon has publicly declared, but this is, by the way, it could be completely bullshit, $4.2 million. In 2021 on union busting activities. United Natural Foods, which I believe is that the Whole Foods one?
I don't know, actually.
Yeah. $2.6 million. HelloFresh has spent $1.6 million. HelloFresh.
Wow.
Jesus Christ.
Why?
Yeah, I don't fucking ask me. A tortilla company spent $1 million. El Milagro Tortillas. Yeah, the American Auto Association spent $2 million. Maine Health, Maine the state, not M-A-I-N-E. Spent $1 million. This is ridiculous shit. Anyways, so basically, how do they, why is it, like, for example, in the US and some other countries, but particularly the US, why is it that they can get away with not actually specifying the amount of money that they spend on these union busting activities, particularly for these consultants? Because in the US, particularly, but also similarly in other countries, the law requires that employers and consultants, it requires that they disclose the agreements that they have between each other. But there's an exception if it's just advice. If you have them on like on retainer just to kind of advise you every once in a while, then you don't need to report shit, right? As long as nothing's pen to paper, which seems like a very stupid, like you could have like a notebook, you know, or
yeah.
Anyways, regardless, through this loophole and other loopholes, it's known that something like between 70 and 90% of employers in the United States hire consultants for union busting activities, up to 90%. But these people almost always rely on this advice exemption loophole. And of course, they have combated heavily certain legislation that they're trying to make sure it doesn't pass, because it would then affect their Unibus activities. One of which is basically the disclosure, this thing that requires the disclosure of agreements with union avoidance consultants. This is an act that was actually suggested, I believe it was called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which was, shot down. There's another one which basically was also shot down. It was a bill to settle Unibus activities as non-tax exempt. Which they currently are. Basically, an employer can hire a union busting consultant and that use as a tax write-off, which seems fucking ridiculous that you can do that. Another one is like that they don't have to report federally on this kind of stuff, which is also ridiculous. There's a bunch of these things. Let's get to the actual details. The most common tactics that people see. Number one, this is basically a recognized law in almost every country. And it is essentially a next to universal law internationally, which is a legal right to unionize. This exists across the world, essentially. In many countries, also, union busting activities are illegal, depending. So it's kind of like this fine line of who will you bribe enough through like campaign donations to kind of get them to look the other way. Anyways, the most common tactics, union busting tactics that they do is, of course, the aforementioned hiring of consultants or agencies where they spend hundreds of millions of dollars on these people, where they basically try to lie or manipulate or threaten workers who are just trying to exercise their rights. They will very commonly, and this is one of the advice things that they give, is the launching of AstroTurf campaigns against unionizing activities, which is this fake, like, quote-unquote homemade, you know, attempt at pretending that there is a anti-union effort within the company or the whatever, like amongst these workers, when there really isn't. It's basically management just creating posters and leaflets and putting out stupid baked goods and whatnot. And then in relation with this, they parrot the same union busting consultant talking points, or they have these little pamphlets, anti-union literature pamphlets, which, by the way, there are certain services that you can go and buy and you look at these things and it's like, oh, look, Susan from accounting was the one who made this. But no, it's an actual like agency that has them printed out. It's so fucking, it's like, oh, place picture of your pet here, like insane shit. But anyways, we should make some merch like that, but it should be pro-union one. And have people put up pictures of their pets. But anyways, they'll have like these fake websites. They put advertisements in the communities, for example. They'll figure out where the greatest concentration of their workers live, and then they're going to be putting anti-union ads there as well. Ridiculous stuff like that. There's captive meetings or captive attention or presence meetings, where basically it's a mandatory, like every worker has to be present to watch and then answer questions correctly, quote unquote correctly, afterwards on union activities, where basically management will be like, hey, all of you will have to sit, you'll have to watch this anti-union video, and then you'll have to talk with this anti-union consultant, and then afterwards you'll get like a little test sheet and you need to fill it in, and you have to fill it in correctly or otherwise they dock you certain things. They try to punish you that way, which, by the way, is illegal, but it happens very frequently. Another one is the abusive ex making promises type of thing, like, oh, I'll never hurt you again, okay, I won't push you down the stairs, I promise. But then afterwards, there's no real change, there's nothing pen to paper. So they'll either tell you that things will improve, or they'll do superficial improvements without pen to paper agreements, so people will give up unionizing efforts, because like, oh yeah, you know, we're seeing some improvements, and then they just go back to being basically the same garbage that they were before. This is a way of guaranteeing no real change. A better way of putting it is the only way to make sure that your employer is held accountable is through unionizing efforts and pen to paper. Other ones, which this is a very frequent one, in the United States and a bunch of other countries across Europe and even different parts of Africa, we've seen these. This is employed extensively, which is delays. Stupid administrative bureaucratic delays. Union busting consultants usually will, it's like the number one advice that they give to employers is to delay as much as you possibly can. The reason is because delays can mean that the economic situation of workers trying to unionize can be hurt. It also means that the lawyers that the particular industries or companies employ will be able to work out some sort of loophole or to get a judge to rule in their favor or some bullshit like this. Or essentially they just kind of try to drag it out to the point that it makes it feel like unions are inefficacious. They won't get you anywhere. Of course, amongst these, you have the fewer, you know, like more common quote-unquote ones, which is things like, oh, wait and see, like maybe the union activity won't get you anything. Let the other workers, like, try to set something up, but you set of workers who are slightly a higher echelon or something, like, you don't bother with this. And they try to kind of, like, divide the working class against each other. They get maybe sometimes some employees also to campaign against them. This is in relation to this AstroTurf point I mentioned. A particularly creepy one is one where they all of a sudden start taking major interest in you and your family. So they send you letters and like flowers and chocolate, hoping to fucking, you know, this stupid superficial shit. They're like, oh no, my worker, my employer cares about me. Sometimes they just go outright into breaking like the law. they'll be like, oh, well, we're going to dock your pay if you try to unionize, or you're going to get fired if you unionize, or things like to that effect, which in many places is illegal. In the United States, it depends on the state, I believe.
Yeah.
Because you have that cringe right to work nonsense. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, is such a two-faced and disgusting way of calling it.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a confusing... For the average person, oh, right to work, that sounds good. That sounds really helpful. Nope, that's sick.
My favorite one is if you go on the Union Busting Playbook website, which has a lot of information on organization and whatnot, it's a fairly useful website. They have a common bluffs, what's it called, like section, and they write, Union Busters follow a script. That's why it's easy for us to tell you what to expect from them. Here are a few common lies busters tell to try to dissuade workers from organizing. Jesus Christ. It's a clunky sentence, right? It's
not just it is. No, it's a clunky sentence.
Okay. One of which is, please give me your natural reactions. Having a union will ruin our family work environment. Please give us another chance.
Oh my God. I love the family talk. It's course, God, it's so
my
gross.
Favorites. Wow. You're telling me you're my racist uncle? Woo! Oh my God. But anyways, what's it called? A general vibe of this is they either try to pull on emotions if you're in a small working group, or they try to go like, oh no, but we're so flexible here, meaning you're going to be able to work. But they're like, oh, but we're flexible. There'll be new rules. Everything will be so rigid. You won't be able to have, like, you know, an open door policy, all this nonsense, which is bullshit, of course. Particularly if they try to be like, if they insinuate that they're going to shut down operations because you're going to unionize, so they want to avoid unionization. This is against the law in many places across the world, including the United States. So them being like, oh, you'll ruin our family work environment, we might have to, you know, like cut down, or like this kind of stuff is basically illegal. They're just wording it in a particular way. They have that other bullshit, which is joining a union may involve you in violence. Oh, the you know, you're going to go out and destroy property and start doing pot.
Terrorist.
Yeah, exactly right. Which is also nonsense. Unions, I mean, the only people who actually end up being violent are cops involved in anti-union activities. But anyways, other bullshit is just outright lies. They'll tell you the union can force you to strike, but when you strike, they won't support you, which is nonsense. Many unions have like a fund for paying people during the, what's called, strike period. Number one. Number two, most unions, if not all unions, to my knowledge, decide on whether they should strike, when and how, by majority vote, etc., etc. So this is nonsense. Another one is the union's only interested in your money and you can't afford union dues. This is the thing that JT and Nico mentioned earlier about the PS5 or whatever. This is also ridiculous because in the long term, like you guys said, if you were to unionize, you would get better pay and better benefits and all this kind of stuff, which in the long term will actually save you money or give you a higher real wage. So yeah, and also, of course, you can look into the research on union members tend to have better treatment, just generally at work, better work conditions, better pay, better benefits, etc. Regardless, if they try to threaten you, is another comment, we won't ever sign a union contract, even if you vote for a union. This is, again, like I told you, it's illegal. And there's resources in every country regarding this. Usually the labor board of or the Ministry of Labor or something like that will have something. Otherwise, then you can pretty much rely on whatever left-wing or communist party is in your country. Not so much in the United States, but in other countries, because they're going to know the ins and outs of all this kind of stuff. Other stuff is like, the usual threats. You'll lose your job, or, oh, the union will control every facet of your life. Oh, this is fucking nonsense. I don't even need to bother. But I want to go through one last bit, which is the modern union busting attempts, and mostly how the capitalist state tries to protect industry. Of course, we're all well aware of Amazon and Starbucks and all these others trying to prevent unionizing activities, and it's always a joke, right? It's like many millions, if not billions of dollars are spent on this. When instead of going into improving the actual lives of the workers, it's so fucking ridiculous.
You'd think, yeah, right?
But that just goes to show how much what's it called? Surplus value they extract, just how much money they make from exploiting their workers. That's why they're willing to pay $400 million for union busting activities, because they're going to make more than $400 million from you not being unionized. That is, frankly, the biggest bit of evidence that you need to get unionized. Of course, many unionizing efforts recognize directly, like, for example, Amazon and Starbucks frequently engage in illegal activity, meaning, like I told you, firing workers, closing down locations that have unionized or threatening to unionize, etc., which, like I mentioned, are illegal. But what successive right-wing governments in the United States, by the way, right-wing meaning both Democrat and Republican, there's no, you know, it doesn't matter, none of them care. They systematically defund the labor board and all other ministries relevant to this. So as a result, they have limited resources to actually engage in investigations of these excesses or these illegal actions. So they can't really punish Starbucks or Amazon or whoever else. Or even if they punish them, they get the lightest slap on the wrist and a fine of like $200,000, which to Amazon is fucking nothing.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's not even the bill for one of their consultants. So anyways, there was one particular example they gave in a Guardian article from the beginning of last year, where they mention a Chipotle restaurant in Augusta, Maine. And basically, they were to become the first Chipotle, which I believe is a restaurant. It says it right there, Chipotle restaurant. Mexican, I assume? Or Latin?
Like California Mexican.
Oh, okay. Is it good?
So burritos. And yeah, it's actually quite good.
All right. That or the homophobic chicken?
Oh, why are you going to make me choose? Gun to my head, I'd say keep Chipotle.
Really? All right. What is your go-to order? Hold on.
I'm interested. All right, check it out. So you're going to get yourself a burrito, right? So you get a big tortilla, one of them tortillas. White rice, black beans, and it's like a cilantro lime rice too, so it's not just plain white rice.
Mm-hmm.
Some hot salsa, like a hot red salsa, then pico de gallo, which if you're not familiar, is like chopped onions, tomatoes, jalapenos, lime juice, carnitas, which is a pork, like a shredded pork. What else do I put on there? Lettuce. I think that's it. I don't go for the cheeses or like the quesos or anything like that. It's good. It's like $10.
Sounds decent.
To switch out the,
it's quite good.
Switch out the pork for chicken. That sounds absolutely lovely.
Come on down here. I'll take you to a Chipotle.
Dude, I had the most discount fucking burrito in my life many years ago. I've only had, I think, like 3 burritos in my whole life. And one of them was in a nondescript third world country, but not anywhere that makes burritos. And it was, I swear to you, it was the size of like a like Colgate toothpaste tube. Basically, that's how big.
So sad. Yeah, that's not that's not even a taco.
It was just beans and rice, but I remember it was so fucking good. And I was like, oh, wow. So I had the most discount burrito, and I was like, this is good. So I can't wait. Anyways.
I am Duner Krau. I'm a Duner boy. Okay. I know I'm not supposed to fucking compare them or whatever, but Duner came first. Okay.
Exactly.
I will
right.
die on this hill.
Anyways, moving swiftly along to this particular Chipotle restaurant in Augusta, Maine. They were hoping to become the first Chipotle in the United States to unionize. But when they were getting close to this point, Chipotle shut down the store. Of course, they were criticized by the labor board at the time. Of legal retaliation, basically shutting it down because they were threatening. Basically, they got a court order to reopen the store. But of course, they have multi-million-dollar funded lawyers. And they just basically said that, oh, no, because of X and Y, Z accounting reason, this is a legitimate business reason to close it down. They said bullshit targets for profit, and they don't reach these bullshit targets. And as a result, they close it down. My point being is that they will always have a quote-unquote legal loophole excuse to get out of this legal retaliation loophole, right? It has to be much more rigidly enforced, but it never is. Yeah, and Brandy McNeese, who is a union worker at the Chipotle, or pro-union worker at this particular Chipotle, he said, and I quote, or they said, excuse me, they closed it down because we were going to get our vote and they were going to lose. It's much easier for a multi-billion dollar corporation to face whatever the consequences are of that than to allow a union into one of their stores, which of course makes sense because if one of them unionizes, then all of them will unionize.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Of course, this is added on top of, for example, Apple illegally spying on their workers as well as threatening them. There was, of course, oh my God, where was it? In Atlanta. It was in Atlanta. There was an Apple store where basically they were forced to withdraw their request for unionization elections, because even though they all voted in favor of unionizing, the thing was shot down through basically some administrative fuckery, which was also again taken basically like this is illegal obstruction of unionization efforts. But they're like, oh no, no, there's a legal reason for it because of X and Y and Z reason. COVID quarantining, so they can't actually hold an election right now because, oh, we can't ensure that digital votes will be actually, how do we know that they're actually our workers and they're not, you know, like this kind of bullshit. They did also. Regardless, all of these steps at every stage are directly reinforced by the courts and police and everywhere else. Very rarely do these unionization efforts in the United States get very far. And when they do get far, they are smeared into the ground. And we saw this mostly with the Amazon union a little while back, if you remember. And this is also exacerbated by the, what's it called? By the this constant delay tactic. But I highly recommend people read this article from The Guardian. It's titled Old School Union Busting, How the U.S. Corporations Are Quashing, well, no, the New Wave of Organizing. The final two things that I'll recommend you guys are two books, of course. One of them, which is pretty good, and one of them is but I mean, if you're interested. The first one is Why You Should Be a Trade Unionist by Len McCluskey, which is a very, very good book. And the second one is It's okay, I guess. There's some historical interest there, at the very least. It's called Trade Unions and Socialist Politics by John Kelly, which is, like I mentioned, it's an okay book. But if you're going to get one, you should read Why You Should Be a Trade Unionist. Yeah, no, that's my bit, okay. Really. And with all that being said, go out and unionize. Try to get familiar with all the union busting techniques. Know that they're always fucking bluffing. Know the law, please. Learn from the Black Panthers. Know the law inside and out so you can tear them a new one with that stuff. It's not that complicated.
Speaking of unions, all of you, we are the capitalist bourgeois that owns this podcast, but you listeners are a metaphoric proletariat. And only for $5 a month or for a bit more, you can join our Patreon union, which allows you to make sure that we do everything right while you keep getting a bunch of extra bonuses, because here at the D program, we're a very rigid, evil corporation, and only those unionized get additional benefits, like early episodes, completely exclusive, 2 episodes a month, access to the Discord community, and even for higher tiers, access to us. So do consider becoming a patron.
Exactly right. No, beautiful, beautifully said. So please do check out the Patreon, check out our Discord. Come chat with us during our live Q&As once a month, all that kind of stuff. We're going to be trying to do also more live streams on the YouTube channel, so do check that out and keep an eye out for that. But yeah, with all that being said, this has been the D Program. I'm Hakeem.
I'm JT.
I'm a Yugopnik. I don't know why I did it that way. yeah. Duners for life, okay? Duners for life. And the great race war of Duners and burritos, I know where
just,
I stand.
Just fade him out.
Where?
Slowly.
Where do you stand? What?